supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Philadelphia City Council has been debating affordable housing policy for more than a year, and this week a compromise was finally reached, with Mayor Jim Kenney agreeing to provide as much as $71 million from the city's general fund to be spent on housing for low-income and working-class residents. WHYY Plan Philly's Jake Bloomgard has been following the story and joins me now. And Jake, this was Philadelphia City Council's first day back after summer break. What happened?
A whole lot. So there's a tax on new construction that council has been fighting for the last 6 months or so. And Mayor Jim Kenney really did not like the idea because he feared it would hurt new construction in the city. And he's also strongly allied with the unions. And a lot of the building trades unions in Philadelphia really depend on the construction boom in order to provide jobs for their guys. So they really didn't want a tax that they felt might put a damper on new development. So it was thought that the mayor might veto the bill. And Mayor Kenney, though, really prides himself on his good relations with council. And he really did not want to veto something. And he especially didn't want to veto something that had the words affordable housing in it, which just, I mean, imagine how bad that would sound to the average voter.
So instead, he offered to pay up to $53 million for affordable housing?
Right. He did that on Wednesday, and council fought back and asked for at least $100 million over 5 years for affordable housing. But in the end, the mayor had the veto threat, and the council members in favor of fighting for the $100 million, they didn't have the votes to overcome it. So in the end, the mayor basically got his way. He did offer this afternoon to try to get them about $18 million more, but that's not for sure. It's kind of dependent on this tricky scheme where real estate interests would have to pay the city more money in exchange for being allowed to build taller buildings with more apartments in them.
Meanwhile, also at City Council today, Councilwoman Cindy Bass introduced a bill eliminating the 10-year property tax abatement.
Yes, that's right. But talking to other people on council, it doesn't sound like she necessarily had the support to get that bill passed. But that does not mean that this bill isn't important. This is the first time anyone has ever suggested getting rid of the 10-year abatement, which is hugely popular among the administration and the real estate industry.
Understandable, because it saves them a lot of money by exempting new construction and rehabilitation projects from paying property taxes for 10 years. It's a pretty big incentive.
Exactly. But you can also see why a lot of longtime residents might hate the idea. They pay their property taxes, and suddenly there's a huge house next door to their row home. Some new people living in it who are not paying taxes. So it is not a winner for council members who hear about it from their constituents all the time. This bill to get rid of the abatement might not get passed, but it is a sign that a lot of politicians want to reform it.
I think at this point we should summarize. Let's see. There's a new bill eliminating the 10-year tax abatement. A tax on new construction has been defeated, and Mayor Kenney has promised up to $71 million for affordable housing. Now, is that amount of activity unusual for a first day of city council back from summer break?
It's extremely unusual. Usually the first day back is pretty boring, and all the important bills don't get discussed until later in the session. But this is kind of a result of the city's housing crisis becoming more and more acute. We have at least 100,000 families who pay over half their incomes on housing.
So for those keeping score, who are the big winners in all this?
The developers really came out well. Council had been arguing about affordable housing for a year, year and a half, and a lot of the bills they've discussed would have hit the developers in their wallets. They would have had to pay through the nose for new affordable housing. But now, all of those bills have gone down. All of them are no longer on the agenda. And instead, you have this thing where the city is basically paying out of the general fund for affordable housing, and so the developers won't have to pay a dime. So they're big winners here, although they probably wouldn't like to say that. Another winner here are the unions. The building trade unions really hated the construction tax idea, and they came out hard against it, and they're seen as responsible in part for the mayor's hard line against it. The last winner, I would say, is Councilwoman Maria Quiñones Sanchez, who began the debate over affordable housing a year and a half ago. A lot of her policies have basically not made it through council. You know, she's experienced a lot of fight back from the unions and from the developers, and she's experienced a lot of pain over this conversation. But if she hadn't introduced a controversial bill last year and fought hard for it, the mayor probably would not be providing this money for affordable housing right now.
Jake, thanks for describing this very busy first day at City Council.
No problem.
That's Jake Blumgart from WHYY's Plan Philly team. Legislation to eliminate the 10-year tax abatement already has supporters in the education realm. Kendra Brooks, a public school advocate with the Our City, Our Schools Coalition, spoke to a rally about ending the abatement earlier today. She says ending the tax break could provide much-needed funds to Philadelphia schools.
We would be able to just make sure kids have safe buildings to go into every day, make sure ceilings aren't falling down in schools and kids still have to attend the next day, make sure teachers aren't going home with face masks because they're being exposed to asbestos and lead. That's unacceptable, and we can't continue to just allow that to happen in our city.
Some economists and developers say the proposed legislation would slow growth in Philadelphia. They believe the tax abatement has been key to revitalizing Philadelphia's center city core. When you get an infection, your immune system kicks into gear to fight off whatever germs have invaded your system. Sometimes, for reasons researchers don't entirely understand, your immune system stops fighting the invaders and turns on itself. That process is called sepsis, and it's a potentially deadly complication that is the leading cause of hospital deaths. WHYY's Dana Bate visited a local hospital on this World Sepsis Day to see how doctors and nurses are training to spot the condition.
We should do piperacillin, which I saw up here.
Doctors and nurses at Penn Presbyterian Medical Center are figuring out which antibiotics to give Sam, a 50-year-old diehard Eagles fan who fell from a lamppost after the Eagles' Super Bowl win.
Flagyl should be 4.
Only Sam isn't real. He's a dummy, lying on a hospital bed in a training room. The medical team is using him as part of an exercise to learn how to spot and treat sepsis. They've set it up like a game, with riddles and clues, like a cryptogram for what they should check next.
19A.
Yeah. Measure on that tape level.
Staff nurse Lauren McPeak helped organize the training and knows about sepsis firsthand. 6 months ago, while in labor with her first child, she developed sepsis from an infection in her uterus.
I was very anxious. I felt like the walls were closing in on me. I felt like I was going to die.
The doctors recognized her symptoms immediately: a high temperature, intense shaking, disorientation. They treated her with antibiotics, and she and her baby survived. That isn't always the outcome. Sepsis accounts for about half the deaths at hospitals across the country. But it can be reversed if it's caught early. That's why Penn Presbyterian Dr. Sean Foster says the key is spotting it as early as possible.
Our goal is to bring sepsis to the front of everybody's mind, to have the team asking, in every case, could this be sepsis, with the goal being that we'll move up the time to treatment.
McPeak says creating this training as a sepsis survivor herself has given her a new perspective on doing her job.
Really made me understand what my patients go through when I do care for a patient that does have sepsis.
Dana Bate, WHYY News.
Last month, the Pennsylvania Attorney General's office released a scathing grand jury report detailing decades of clergy sex abuse within 6 of the state's 8 Roman Catholic dioceses. However, the overwhelming majority of the priests named in the report cannot be prosecuted, either because they're dead or the statute of limitations has run out. But as WHYY's Aaron Moselle reports, the same may not be true for the church officials who supervise those priests, thanks to a landmark case in Philadelphia.
It all dates back to 2011. That year, the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office released a grand jury report about clergy sex abuse that did something different, something unprecedented. Among others, the report concluded that Monsignor William Lynn, a top church official with the Archdiocese of Philadelphia, was criminally culpable, not because he abused children, but because he put suspected pedophile priests in a position to abuse by recommending transfers to new parishes. For that, Lynn was charged with child endangerment, It was a big deal.
There just was this widespread understanding that endangerment in the state of Pennsylvania meant that you had to be responsible and overseeing particular children.
Marcy Hamilton is CEO of Child USA, a think tank that fights child abuse and neglect.
So you had to be the playground supervisor or a teacher. And this whole concept of being responsible to children in an organization from far up the hierarchy was thought to be a novel concept.
Novel, but it worked. In 2012, after 3 months of testimony, a jury found Lynn guilty of child endangerment. It was the first time a U.S. Catholic Church official was convicted of covering up clergy sex abuse. Here's former Philadelphia District Attorney Seth Williams speaking at a press conference after the landmark verdict.
What happened here was unspeakable. People knew that these were predators, but were much more concerned with the institution than the victims of sexual assault.
Lynn was sentenced to 3 to 6 years in prison. His lawyers appealed the conviction, first by challenging the district attorney's use of the state's child endangerment law. The issue went all the way to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, where the justices sided with the DA, saying, yes, this is a legitimate way to prosecute child sex abuse in Pennsylvania. William Spade is a criminal defense attorney and a former assistant district attorney.
There was no precedent to say that the prosecutor could hold that organization accountable until the Pennsylvania Supreme Court made that ruling.
It's why even after Lynn's conviction was overturned on a different appeal, the district attorney's office still had the option of retrying him, and why it's now possible other Catholic Church officials like him could be charged in Pennsylvania. To Marcy Hamilton with Child USA, that should include the dozens of supervisors named in the 900-page grand jury report released last month by the Attorney General's office, including the current Bishop of Pittsburgh and the now Cardinal of Washington, D.C. All told, the report accuses more than 300 priests of abusing more than 1,000 children, while their bosses sometimes look the other way.
The abuse itself is separate from the cover-up. What endangerment does is it opens the door to criminal charges based on the cover-up, unrelated to any particular victim being sexually abused.
Bill Donahue, president of the Catholic League for Religious and Civil Rights, says Hamilton is wrong, that nothing from the grand jury report should have legal consequence.
The grand jury report, as far as I'm concerned, is virtually meaningless. It's totally accusatory. It's not evidentiary.
We'll have to wait and see what the Attorney General's office thinks. Asked whether charges were possible for supervisors in the grand jury report, a spokesman emailed a four-word response. The investigation is ongoing. Aaron Moselle for Keystone Crossroads.
The percussion quartet called So Percussion will mark the beginning of their fifth year as performers in residence at Princeton University with a concert tomorrow evening. Newsworks Tonight producer Kimberly Ha spoke with two members of the ensemble, Jason Truding and Adam Slawinski. She began by asking Trudy, what's in a name?
Yes, right? What is in a name? So is a very, very old Japanese kind of root, which means to offer sound. And you don't find it very much in the language anymore, but it's kind of rooted in this kind of a beautiful idea of offering sound.
And you have more of a mission than just to play whatever percussion repertoire happens to be available to a contemporary ensemble. You're composers, and you also commission work.
That's correct. But we started out as an ensemble in the model of a kind of string quartet playing contemporary music, so working with composers. We still do that all the time. That's a big part of what we do and a big part of the concert we're playing in Princeton tomorrow evening. We do write our own music. We collaborate with musicians who aren't necessarily from the classical fold. And even our organization actually really believes in doing service work, social work. We think of music as an activity that bonds communities together.
And one of those commissions was to Steve Reich.
Yeah, and that was actually one of our most exciting commissions in a certain way, because we grew up kind of idolizing his music, and in a lot of ways it was what drew us to do what we do.
Also mentioned working with composers who are not in really in the world of contemporary classical music, and I guess Bryce Dessner is a good example of that.
The first time we actually met Bryce was that we were at the Yale School of Music as grad students together. He was a classical guitar major. So while it's true that he wasn't a composer who kind of got a PhD in composition, he's a very versatile musician who has this huge career in this big rock band, The National, who play stadiums and festivals. But he also is just a very, very deep musician. And this piece, Music for Wood and Strings, that he wrote for us is fantastically creative. He invented a new string instrument for us to play like dulcimers, but it sounds like guitars. So we just love the idea that so many different kinds of influences go into a collaboration like that.
Entering your fifth year now in your residency at Princeton, how did that come about and what do you do there?
So the idea of a music ensemble in residence, traditionally that's been something like a string quartet because, of course, it reaches back into the classical tradition so that people will play Beethoven, Bartok, things like that. When we started here, almost 5 years ago now, part of the idea was that Princeton has a very large community of composers and people who are making new works of music. And what we do as a percussion ensemble since the very beginning is to generate new repertoire and new music. And part of that for us is because we didn't have much repertoire to begin with. So we've been developing relationships with composers, including people here at Princeton, for many years. And when this position came open, it was the Brentano String Quartet before us. When they went to Yale, Princeton was interested in this idea of trying something different. And so we've been defining a music residency in a new way for us. How does a percussion ensemble fit into a music community and a music department? And it's been a really wonderful experience. We started a steel band here at Princeton. We do a lot of improvisation and composition and all kinds of things that we really love.
And what's on tomorrow's program? Let's have a little rundown of that.
Tomorrow is an incredibly eclectic program. We're doing 8 pieces, and everyone looks and sounds completely different. We have pieces by 2 members of the group, Jason, and also Eric Chubich. We have a piece by a Princeton faculty composer, Ju Riso, Paulina Oliveros, Yannis Anakis, Angelica Negron, Vijay Iyer, and Joan Tower.
Yep. Joan Tower just wrote us a piece. She's celebrating her 80th birthday. It's called Small Plus. So it takes things that you can kind of fit in a suitcase and puts them on a bunch of tables around the stage. So everything we're playing is tiny, but there's a lot of sound. And Vijay Iyer's piece, he wrote it for us. He's really well known as a jazz pianist, but has a really kind of intriguing rhythmic sensibility. So he wrote us a mallet quartet. It's called Torque.
Jason, can you talk about your Sudoku series?
Over the last year, I've gotten really interested in Sudoku. I just really love looking at patterns. So I'm in the midst of writing a whole series of 9 pieces inspired by Sudoku, and all of them have the puzzle itself as the basis for the score. So, for example, So is going to be joined by 2 original members of So Percussion, actually some really great friends, Todd Meehan and Doug Perkins. We're going to play 9 Number 6, premiere tomorrow night. So all of us will have the 9x9 matrix of Sudoku in front of us, and the music we'll play will come from that. But if you were to go out to LA and a different 6 percussionists were to play that piece, they could find a different Sudoku puzzle and play the piece as well based on the different numbers. There'll be a similarity when you hear different groups play different puzzles, but also a kind of uniqueness.
Well, thanks very much for being here. I've been talking with Jason Truding and Adam Slewinski of the group So Percussion. They're going to be performing at Princeton University tomorrow evening as part of their residency with the university. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
That's NewsWorks Tonight producer Kimberly Haas. We end tonight's show with a programming announcement. This is the final week for NewsWorks Tonight, and starting Monday at this time, you'll be hearing All Things Considered. And of course, you'll hear the great work of our local news team throughout the day. In October, WHYY will be launching a new local news show and podcast. Stay tuned for details. The Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller. Newsworks Tonight.